Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Coming up on the program, we'll revisit the story of the Westmoreland coal bankruptcy and what that means for the future.
I do not expect many of those mines to continue operating post-bankruptcy. And so that's going to mean some layoffs.
Republican candidate for governor Mark Gordon joins us to discuss a variety of subjects, including reducing spending in education.
Allow and expect our local school boards to be able to make some more determinations about their district-by-district budget decisions.
A 100-year-old squabble between Wyoming and the Philippines over a pair of bells may finally get resolved.
Plus stories on climate change and our latest I Respectfully Disagree. It's coming up on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. Westmoreland Coal Company has filed for bankruptcy. It's one of the largest and oldest coal producers in North America. The company's fall is one of the latest signs coal markets are not bouncing back, despite the Trump administration's intentions. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
In southwest Wyoming, the Kimmer coal mine is the largest contributor of tax revenue to the county and a big employer. It's owned by Westmoreland, whose recent bankruptcy has locals on edge. Mike Delpaz represents employees there through the United Mine Workers of America.
Our people are just worried to death about their jobs, their pensions, their health care.
The Kimmer Mine employs about 280 people and provides benefits to many more, like retirees and widows. It's not clear yet what the bankruptcy means, like whether people will lose their jobs. The same concerns go beyond Wyoming. Westmoreland has nearly 3,000 employees in 7 states and Canada. Delpaz says there are still a lot of unknowns.
Oh, it is most certainly chaotic. We're not too sure that they're sure what they're doing.
The bankruptcy itself was expected. Westmoreland hired restructuring advisors last spring and have been seeing difficulties for much longer. It's purchased large mines that didn't pan out. Westmoreland's debt shot up to over $1 billion. Its share price tanked. Energy analysts say its business strategy was also a big issue, which sells one mine's coal to one primary customer versus shipping coal where the demand is.
The idea is to remove some of the market volatility and have a secure customer. What has turned out to be a good and sound strategy has turned into somewhat of a problem for them.
That's Andy Blumenfeld, an analyst with Doyle Trading Consultants. I spoke with him last May about Westmoreland's struggles. Several of the company's primary customers moved away from coal, and now more are scheduled to do the same thing. Wyoming's Kimmer Mine serves a coal-fired power plant, which is expected to retire one of its generating units this coming January. Another major customer of Westmoreland is closing down half its coal-fired generating units by 2022, another by 2027. Blumenfeld says its dependence on this mine mouth system was a fatal flaw.
It's kind of a sad situation. This is a mainline coal company. You know, Westmoreland is a name that's been around for a very long time.
The fall of coal-fired power plants like the ones that rely on Westmoreland's coal is part of a larger trend. Utilities are closing them in unprecedented numbers and moving towards more competitive natural gas and renewable energy. In 2009, there were 530 active coal plants. This past March, there were only 262. That means over half of all plants retired in just 9 years. It comes despite the Trump administration's efforts to bolster coal, with the Clean Power Plan repeal, leaving the Paris Accord, not to mention an attempt to immediately save struggling coal plants from closing. Delpaz says he was hopeful.
What we all heard during, I guess maybe you call it your campaigns, coal was going to get a heck of a shot in the arm. Well, it hasn't.
Delpaz blames the company, too, saying it made bad investments, and that mines like Kimmer could easily be profitable.
Westmoreland just doesn't do a very good job at it, you know, meaning from their corporate offices all the way, you know, to the coal mine.
And so Westmoreland went bankrupt with over $1 billion of debt. Now a group of lenders is in charge. They forgave the debt owed to them in exchange for Westmoreland's assets. The group will try to leverage that to make back as much money as they can. Sierra Club senior attorney Peter Morgan says that will likely happen by selling off assets. Bankruptcy filings back that up.
I think the lenders have made the calculation that the only way they're going to get any of their money back is if they get their hands on whatever parts of the company have some value and get rid of the parts of the company that have the highest liabilities. And frankly, they're still probably going to suffer a loss.
The group is expected to hold on to only two mines, one in New Mexico, the other in Montana. And smaller operations, including Kimmer, will likely be auctioned off and ideally kept running by another operator, according to a Westmoreland spokeswoman, meaning jobs will be retained. The company said no layoffs were expected as a result of its restructuring announcement. But Morgan doesn't believe it.
I do not expect many of those mines to continue operating post-bankruptcy. And so that's going to mean certainly some layoffs.
Beyond jobs, if the Kemmer mine is closed or sold without certain assurances, some environmental advocacy groups are worried what that means for reclamation costs and taxes. In August, Lincoln County said bankruptcy could lead to $11 million in unpaid taxes, meaning Wyoming could be in for its own fight. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
You've probably never heard of the Balangiga Bells, but for years they've been at the center of a tussle between Wyoming and the Philippines. That century-old fight might finally be coming to an end, Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen explains.
During a State of the Nation address last year, the president of the Philippines, Rodrigo Duterte, called on the U.S.
Give us back those Balangiga Bells.
The bells were seized in 1901 during the Philippine-U.S. conflict.
They are ours. They belong to the Philippines. They are part of our national heritage.
Since that seizure at the turn of the century, the Philippines has not heard the Balangiga bells rung. That's because they've remained on display in Cheyenne, Wyoming, on the F.E. Warren Air Force Base.
I'll give you a little history of the bells on the base, because it's really interesting.
That's historian Rick Ewig. He says in order to understand how the bells ended up in Wyoming, you need to know a little bit about the Spanish-American War.
It's over by late 1898, and with the Treaty of Paris signed, the U.S. then takes control over the Philippines.
He says many Filipinos thought the U.S. would quickly grant them independence, but that didn't happen.
Tensions rose between the locals and the Filipinos fighting for independence with the troops there in the garrison. And then on September 28, 1901, the garrison was attacked by Filipinos.
And he says the Balangiga Bells played a role in that attack.
Apparently because, you know, they were in the church, and to start the attack against the troops on the 28th of September, the church bells were rung. And that said, go ahead and attack.
48 U.S. servicemen and an estimated 20 to 30 Filipinos died in the attack. Afterwards, U.S. General Jacob Smith ordered more troops to the area.
And he had some very harsh words he used to describe what he wanted done. He said that he wanted that area to become a howling wilderness.
He says the fighting in Balangiga continued for a few more months, but eventually the garrison closed down, and when the troops left, they took the bells with them. They ended up in Fort D.A. Russell, which is now F.E. Warren Air Force Base in Wyoming. And Ewig says it didn't take long before the first discussions about where the bells belonged started to happen.
By 1911, there was a general in the Philippines who was questioning the propriety of really taking church bells as war souvenirs.
Ewig says for the last 100 years, all kinds of people have asked the bells be returned. That includes Filipino ambassadors, Catholic church leaders, even President Bill Clinton. More recently, the American Philippine Society came out in support of returning the bells. Wyoming's congressional delegation disagrees with the possible return. In a joint statement, they said, quote, "We believe that moving the bells establishes a dangerous precedent for future veterans' memorials," unquote. That's in line with local Wyoming veterans groups who've consistently opposed the move over the years.
Well, I think there's an emotional attachment to them.
That's Stephen Kravinsky, the executive director of the Wyoming Veterans Commission. He says Wyoming veterans consider the bells a war memorial.
You know, sending it back would dishonor the soldiers who were killed in the Philippines.
But the U.S. federal government has the final word on where the bells belong. Secretary James Mattis said they belong in the Philippines. He notified Congress this summer that the Defense Department intends to return them, although no date has been set as of yet. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we'll have our latest I Respectfully Disagree as we discuss the slogan, "The World Needs More Cowboys." This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Caroline Ballard. The University of Wyoming has a new recruitment campaign featuring the slogan, "The World Needs More Cowboys." It rolled out with a video and new advertising materials, but some on campus are not happy about it. Christine Porter is a professor of community and public health and says the slogan excludes women and people of color. Helen Raleigh is a Chinese-American UW alum. She also writes for the conservative publication The Federalist and recently published an article supporting the new slogan. Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards brought the two women together over a video conference call for our series, I Respectfully Disagree. Helen Raleigh says she was impressed with her UW classmates' diversity.
Two-thirds of my classmates were women, and many of them are international students. I have some people from Norway, some people from Sweden, and a couple of people like me from China. I never feel not welcomed or alone or out of space. I always feel very welcomed by everybody. And honestly, I love the video. The video showed a diverse body of people and many women and many people of colors. And the message is really about the spirit, you know, being underdog, to be able to break out of the status quo. And those are all the things I learned when I was there. And those are all the things I enjoy to have as an immigrant. You know, I came to here all by myself. I thought that's perfectly embody what the school is about and what my experience was.
And so, Christine, I wonder, you know, just listening to her story and then remembering your own reaction to the first time that you saw the campaign slogan. So I also like the video and the message in the video for all the reasons that you said, Helen. My struggle and my concern has always been exclusively and only about the slogan itself.
Okay.
That the world needs more cowboys as the standalone slogan for a public institution. I mean, some people have interpreted my concerns about this as saying we should change Steamboat as our logo or change the name of our teams. And absolutely, no, I have no problem with any of those. And I will also say that our female teams are not called the Cowboys, ever. We never pretend that the women who play representing our great university are Cowboys. We always call them Cowgirls. And if we want to refer to them together, we use the phrase cowpokes, right? Go pokes. And so my concern about the slogan, the one I can also speak to the most because it's the most factual, right, is that boys, it is male. And so that's my primary. I feel excluded as a woman. And I can tell you my daughter doesn't even want to see these. Like she used to think about UW and now she doesn't. Related is the idea of cowboy also includes whiteness. And I don't mean, I know that a lot of cowboys in actual history were men of color, but if you search in Google Images for the word cowboy, I did that in July, right? And 97% of them appear to be white, of the people who are identifiable. And that is the public image of cowboy, right? So that is what we're projecting across the country, because that is the popular image of a cowboy, is able-bodied, heterosexual, male, and white. And so my concern is a public university saying the world needs more of that specifically to the exclusion of females in particular. So Helen, I wonder if you can kind of just, what are you hearing that Christine is saying, and what would your response be?
To me, the word cowboy, I mean, I'm thinking about another word, human, right? Human, the word human ends with men. But when we say the word human, when we think of all three of us are human, do we think a human excluded all of us because it ends with the M-A-N? No, we don't. So to me, the word cowboy, if we really go down this road, and also to many people like me, the word cowboy does not represent racial or gender, but it represents values, represent just like the ad said, it represents a spirit. When you think about cowboy, you think about someone, not necessarily a man, who's willing to go to the unknown, who's willing to go into the, take the adventure. And Christine was right that, and I also researched that actually historically, 1 in 4 cowboys are black. And actually after the Civil War, cowboy was a profession one of the very few professions that provide African-American men very good job, high paying jobs. And also there are many Native Indians who are cowboys as well. Maybe the solution is to get more education into the historical facts rather than just focus on the very limited image created by Hollywood, which is again, very left-leaning progressive place that only create a white male as the cowboys.
What do you think of that idea, Christine, of just could some sort of an education campaign associated with this slogan maybe satisfy some of your concerns?
Absolutely would not satisfy any of my concerns about the slogan, because the slogan, of course, is using the word cowboy. And unfortunately, we don't get to just say, oh, we're gonna say boys or girls. We're going to say the image that the country has is wrong. And this institution, just with this campaign, is going to change all that. That is not to say that I don't value that effort a lot. And I actually think University of Wyoming is particularly well placed to do that kind of public re-education. I think that's important, re-education about the truth about cowboys. It still does not change the gender aspect. And, you know, Helen, you used the example of human. And if you look up human in the dictionary, it doesn't mean a man. And if you look up woman in the dictionary, it doesn't mean a man just because it has the word man in it. The word boy is much more specific.
So I wonder if you have any suggestions of what they might have done differently with that. I mean, if you could have your druthers, what would you have preferred?
So I would have said the world needs more trailblazers. I think many of the ideas and the values that are very powerful in the slogan are captured by that without the gender, race, able-bodied, heteronormative parts of the slogan. They were asking us as members of, you know, the UW community to try to help everyone feel like they're a member of this and they're included. I was like, well, maybe it would help if you, could you give us one of these posters and things that says the world needs more cowgirls? And our head of marketing said to me that the marketing firm said that would be pandering and not to do that.
What do you think, Helen, of her suggestion of the world needs more trailblazers or something along those lines that might take the gender issue out of the slogan? Any thoughts on that?
Well, I don't mind if you say, you know, water needs more trailblazers, but you have to think this is a university campaign, right? The purpose is to attract new students, and both domestically and internationally. And as someone, you know, who came from another country, you know, the Hollywood influence is far and wide throughout the globe. So the word cowboy to many people from another culture is really the embodiment of America. One thing does bother me is that not all minorities think alike, not all women think alike. And we don't want somebody else to basically say, this is offensive to all minorities, this is offensive to all women. Well, that's not true, right? Some of us do think differently, and our voice should be heard as well, not just because, you know, it may not necessarily be politically correct. And I do think a political correctness has been taken too far. I mean, college campuses should be the least place for this to happen. You know, I came from a oppressive regime, and I do not want to see this happen, which should be the freest place in this country. That is college campuses, where free inquiry of ideas, you know, civil debate, civil conversations. But I think most people from the right who have a problem is when there is a demand to say, this is the only term you can use, this is the only phrase you can use, this is the only thought you're allowed to have, then to me, that is a censorship.
But actually, the thing that interests me most about what you said, Helen, was the idea of censorship.
right? And I would think you would know from coming from communist China, right? The difference between censorship and civic debate about what is good and right to talk about. And I would just say that there are light years of difference between censorship, what we are not allowed to say, either because of university policy, state policy, federal policy, and culture about what we consider to be acceptable, right? And that is what we consider to be acceptable, that is the location of civic dialogue and debate. And sweeping things aside as politically correct, or sweeping things aside as saying, oh, you are racist, you are sexist, and therefore I'm not going to listen to you and you're stupid. Like, both of those things are bad. And then neither of them are censorship, but neither of them are leading to a civic dialogue. Okay, so here we have just conducted a conversation. What do you guys think? How did this work to try and have a real conversation about hard things over a screen?
I think we should have more. I think it doesn't make a difference when you look at somebody in the eyes and see another face, you know, see what's behind the, you know, the Twitter handles or the, you know, the Facebook pictures, that you actually see what you're talking to is another fellow human being who just happens to disagree with you. I think have more and more face-to-face discussion is really a way to help repair some of the damage that social medias have done to our society. But I do like this format. You know, technology, like you mentioned, technology can be useful. Let's use it for the right purpose, and also realize the limitation that technology, especially the downside that the technology has done damage to our life.
That was Wyoming Public Radio's Melody Edwards conducting a civil discourse with the Federalist contributor Helen Raleigh and UW professor Christine Porter. To watch a video of their complete conversation, visit our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org.
When we come back, we'll have a couple of stories on climate change, and later in the show, an interview with Republican candidate for Governor Mark Gordon. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. Rising sea levels for some and catastrophic droughts and wildfires for others are imminent unless immediate action is taken to reduce greenhouse gas emissions. That's at least according to a new report from the United Nations. Yet in Wyoming, only 60% of adults believe that global warming is actually happening. University of Cincinnati anthropologist Daniel Murphy has studied how humans make decisions in the face of environmental changes from Mongolia to the Mountain West. He says the key to starting conversations about what to do about climate change is not to mention it at all. Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson sat down with Murphy to find out more.
If you're having a conversation about adapting to something in the future, to what degree do people need to be on the same page about the fact that there is change on the horizon?
This was one of the interesting things that came out of our first research project that we did in southwest Montana in the Big Hole Valley. A couple towns there, Jackson, Wisdom, and Wise River. Predominantly, these are ranching communities. But there's small business, there's outfitters, hunting outfitters, fishing outfitters. So there's a lot of activity in that particular landscape. And what we noticed was, well, one, we didn't need to come out and say that this is climate change, because everyone we talked to recognized that there's change. And we spoke to ranchers who would give us stories about, you know, when they were kids, the snow was up above the fence every year, snow above the fence, and that they don't see that anymore. And they talk about they have much bigger herds of pronghorn. There are no moose anymore down in the valley. And so they notice these changes. And so that's an entry point for them to start thinking about the future, that they can kind of, oh, you know what? I've seen this. And people, once they're able to see themselves in that, then they're able to craft meaning and establish that, oh, I have continuity in this landscape. This isn't the end of the world, that I can do things here. And I think that's empowering. When you're talking about iconic changes, whether it's these massive hurricanes like you just saw in Florida, sea level rise, that is a different way of attaching onto and putting meaning on and establishing understanding with this larger global process. When you live on the land and you make your living from the land, like many people in Wyoming do and the West do, that is less meaningful because it's kind of one signal in the environment. When they know that there are many signals, there's a lot going on. So there's these different ways you attach meaning to those things that I think are really, really important and are different for different people when you live in different places and interact with the world in different ways.
That idea is really interesting, the sort of the way that we emotionally respond to mm-hmm. something that is apocalyptic, where we're like, ooh, we're not going to make it, the doom and gloom, versus the I'm imagining a future, it might change, but I can envision how I would survive. What I hear you saying is that that doesn't shut us down in the same way, that if we can see ourselves adapting, that we stay in the conversation. If we're told we're all toast, then we check out and we don't do anything about it.
If you're told you're all toast and you already don't believe in this particular narrative about climate change, then yeah, you've hit a bunch of walls there. And so I think, yeah, framing the conversation in the right way gets people to stay in the game and less likely to, you know, to put up those walls and put up those barriers. For example, let's go back to the father and son who, you know, they go out elk hunting every year, right? And they're noticing changes in the size of the elk herd. And they used to have a favorite hunting spot, and that's radically changing. And then they go home to their ranch and they see, you know, the irrigation ditches are not filling up like they used to. The snowpack is lower than it used to be. And they start putting together things. They see these things because these things are not just, quote unquote, resources, right? They're things that they have attached memory to. Attaching memory to, you know, that relationship with their father or attaching relationship. You know, I had a rancher who talked about how much he loved his cows and how, like, these changes affecting his cows broke his heart. And so it's those memories and that meaning that's attached to these things that you see changing. That's an entry point.
And I guess for me, my big takeaway from your work and what you've observed is that the better starting place is not the question, like, what are you going to do about this? It's what are you seeing in the place where you live? But I guess I'm wondering, is that going to save us?
For me, that's the only way to have the conversation. If you disagree with somebody, what you have to do is sit down face to face and you listen, and they convey those sentiments and that emotion and that feeling. You know, most people, they empathize, and we start to see the world through somebody else's eyes. And I think when you have those personal connections, that's the beginning of something. Now, that's small, right? And this problem is really big. So I get the sense of, okay, this seems like a huge scale issue. We're not at the right scale with that. But to me, there's no reason not to have those conversations. And you talk to that rancher who says, you know, this year has been a bad year. Talk to them. Well, what have you been doing about it? What do you plan to do about it? Is everybody else, you know, seeing this? If you go straight into saying, well, that's climate change, buddy. yeah, that could be the end of the conversation. I mean, why would somebody want to talk to you about that? You just told them what their world is, and you just finished their story for them. And I think that's a problem. And so good listening is a very good habit to get into.
That was University of Cincinnati anthropologist Daniel Murphy speaking with Wyoming Public Radio's Tennessee Watson.
Staying with the topic of climate change, We love our outdoors and wildlife in the Mountain West, but that connection makes us vulnerable to a growing mental health problem known as climate anxiety. Ali Budner explains.
Wander around any town center or school campus around here and ask this question.
What are your feelings about climate change?
And you may hear something like this.
I would say dread and grief are good words to describe that.
I can't remember a time where I wasn't like thinking about it. It's always like in the back of my mind.
I know the ice is melting and then like the sea level is rising. That sounds kind of scary and very worrying.
Yeah, it's bad.
Things just got even scarier with the United Nations' latest report on climate change.
A stark warning from the United Nations Panel on Climate.
This wasn't scientists rising up.
Climate change can reach crisis levels.
It would increase heat waves, flooding, drought, and the loss of species.
It's enough to make anyone anxious, and groups like the American Psychological Association and the American Psychiatric Association are paying attention. They're publishing reports on how the fear of climate change can harm mental health. Sabrina Helm wanted to find out who among us is the most vulnerable. She's a researcher at the University of Arizona. She did a survey of several hundred people and found that
people who have a concern about nature and the environment in general, plants and animals, those are the ones who also report highest ecological stress, unfortunately also depression.
Helm believes people in the deserts of the West are especially sensitive.
You are very aware about how fragile the natural environment is.
For Helm, who moved from Germany to the Desert West some years ago, all of this hits home.
It seems very dire to me. You know, if you read so much the research, which paints not such a nice picture of future developments, it affects researchers as well.
In fact, based on Helm's research, people who study the environment may actually be among the most affected by climate anxiety. People like Michael Lucid. He's a conservation biologist in northern Idaho. A few years ago, he and his wife discovered a new species of slug.
It was really exciting to find a new species.
Only to discover it was vulnerable to climate change. He says it was disorienting to add a creature to the known world and simultaneously fear for its future. But he says climate change is part of his everyday reality as a biologist, as a parent, and as a mountain dweller.
The last 2 summers in August has just been horrific smoke, and that has really gotten people talking about climate change, I think.
He says it makes him sad, but
it also really motivates me to work and find solutions for wildlife.
This positive attitude fits with Sabrina Helm's research. Her study found that people who are the most stressed or depressed about global warming also tend to be the most proactive about finding solutions. Laura Schmidt is a perfect example of this. She's a recent environmental humanities graduate from the University of Utah.
My knowledge throughout grad school greatly increased, as well as my anxiety. And then I realized that you have to do something, right?
So she started convening support groups in Salt Lake City for people to talk about their climate anxieties. The group became what she now calls the Good Grief Network. She says climate anxiety is something mainstream psychotherapy just hasn't addressed head on yet.
You know, seeing the world around us come crashing down or be changed in ways we can't even imagine is definitely going to have a psychological toll on us.
So she's growing the Good Grief Network beyond Utah and even beyond the U.S. into Canada and Europe. While developing the program, Schmidt interviewed scientists, activists, and writers about how they cope during hard times.
Almost everybody said that, you know, they had some sort of spiritual practice. You know, some people were like, I go for a walk in the forest.
Or for some folks, it could be a church. Tom Trinidad is the pastor at Faith Presbyterian Church in Colorado Springs.
Some folks come to the church and they just want to be able to unburden their concerns and their hearts. And that's all we can do sometimes. But if you only say, just trust God and there's nothing you can do about it, then that also robs them of the dignity of their human responsibility. And so we try to do a little bit of both.
He says even Pope Francis wrote a lengthy treatise on actively dealing with climate change.
So I would say that all of us need to be talking about this.
For Laura Schmidt, it's as simple as this.
You can see this as a great opportunity for connection and for meaning and for community building, or you can sort of shut down and look the other way.
For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Ali Budner.
When we come back, a conversation with Republican candidate for Governor Mark Gordon. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Caroline Ballard.
And I'm Bob Beck. State Treasurer Mark Gordon is the Republican candidate for governor. Gordon is a former businessman and owns a ranch in Johnson County. He joins me to discuss a number of issues. Well, Treasurer Gordon, first off, thank you so much for taking time. I want to start right off the bat with a question that has been raised by several of our listeners. Right now, members of the LGBTQ community can be fired due to their sexual orientation. They can face housing discrimination. They lack protections from discrimination. So a question is what would you be willing to do to address some of those issues and concerns?
Oh, Bob, thank you. It's nice to be here. And that's a question that comes up from time to time. Wyoming, I think, has probably one of the best statements in its Constitution, Article 1, Sections 2 and 3. And I recognize that, there are some who feel that you need to have specialized laws for this. I don't share that opinion. I think crimes are crimes, and if there's discrimination, we need to deal with that. And I as governor, I would like to deal with that on a straight up fashion.
But again, the issue of people maybe not getting housing or being fired just because they're gay or lesbian or transgendered. There are people that think those protections should be in law. Do you disagree with that?
Yeah, I think there's probably better ways. I think when we start creating all these special classes of people, it tends to make a lot of business for lawyers, I guess, maybe my concern, and doesn't really address the root problem, which is really that we should treat everybody pretty much the same.
And to follow up on that, as you well know, one of Van Dow's recommendations is to pass some sort of an anti-discrimination law that would actually deal with some of these protections. The thought, I guess, is that it would be easier to get more workers here and create some new businesses. Do you buy that?
I really don't know what the statistics on that would be. When I think of Wyoming and what's attractive to Wyoming, it is the fact that we have fewer regulations. It's that, it's a place that you can do more. And I'll go back just a little bit, remembering the fact that this was the month where Matthew Shepard, 20 years ago, was brutally killed and and dealt with that. And one of the challenges that I dealt with at that time was that I was on the search committee for our church's pastor, a replacement pastor, and we had a wonderful guy who called up and said, I can't go to a place like Wyoming because it's a horrible place to be, Matthew Shepard. And yet, if you think about it, and you think about the moral, of the Laramie Project, this is a wonderful state with open and wonderfully accepting people. I'm not sure a body of law changes the fact that we are a great state or makes it even more, any more attractive. I think we just have to deal with that.
Mark Gordon visiting with us. He's your Republican candidate for governor. Changing gears a little bit, the Joint Judiciary Committee has been certainly looking at some of the challenges in our prison system as it pertains to our growing prison population. Some of the things they want to do include putting more resources into substance abuse treatment, working reform, how those on probation and parole are handled, trying to find some alternatives to prison. The changes might cost some upfront money with the idea that you would get long-term savings. I wonder if you've looked into this at all and what your thoughts are on that.
Well, we do know some of the base economics of that. There is some upfront cost. It's an investment that you should yield results, and I think probably yield results a little more broadly across sectors. I serve on something called Volunteers of America. We've got a halfway house in Gillette, and that program seems to have had some real success. Our substance abuse programs, this isn't a pitch for Volunteers of America, it is a pitch for saying that I think these treatment programs and being able to do something other than just incarcerate people actually pays benefits back.
One of the things, a couple of the judges, and I just drew a blank on the one from Pinedale, but said to the committee is that they would probably recommend more community placement and other options if those options were available to them?
You know, before I was on Volunteers of America, I was on the Northern Wyoming Mental Health Center. I think these programs we need to strengthen in the state. I've had a couple of recommendations along those lines. We need to be able to recruit more counselors, more people to be able to help with those with those programs. And I think the other thing is just sort of getting communities ramped up and able to take these on by helping those services.
Mark Gordon again chatting with us. You know, speaking of prison, it does appear something, and I hate the term kicking the can down the road, but it appears we've done this again. The next governor is going to probably have to address the Rawlins facility. It's been crumbling. It's been breaking down. I know you've gone on record not wanting to do a lot of extra construction, but I'm curious if that's something we've got to fix and how you might go about doing that.
No, I feel it needs absolutely to be addressed, and the legislature has looked at it, and as has the State Building Commission. That's something that the electeds sit on, and I'm very much aware of the challenges. We are addressing those over time, and hopefully there's a view that we can stabilize some of the major factors. It's going to be more expensive than we wanted, but I think trying to relocate the prison, build from the ground up, all of those kinds of things at this point doesn't seem warranted.
Does it? I mean, you've heard more of the experts than I have. Does it sound like if you do the fixes you're talking about, it will last for the long term?
Well, it'll certainly last longer, and I think that's kind of the key point. You know, one of the other pieces that I think we do have to address goes back to that first question you had, which is our general population, mm-hmm. In particularly when we're very low on women's beds, and there, you know, we may want to, as a state, start looking at those sentencing guidelines and figure out if we can, you know, direct people more to substance abuse programs, because we do have a tremendous amount of people that are incarcerated for that.
Well, as we've heard you say many times, you've been on record opposing Medicaid expansion, and if I'm not paraphrasing too easily, but long-term costs seem to be the concern there. Certainly mm-hmm. the costs, we aren't going to be getting the reimbursement that we would have gotten had we done this earlier. Hospitals in the state, though, continue to say that the numbers of people without insurance are impacting their bottom line. So if we don't go with expansion, what can we do to address that low-income population, the folks that can't afford insurance, and also maybe help our overall healthcare system at the
sure,
same time?
Sure, sure. Well, Bob, as I've said before, my biggest concern with Medicaid expansion is under the sort of legal framework we have today and the political framework that we have today, I think it's a way of papering over, and if I were a hospital administrator, I'd want to have my costs addressed, mm-hmm. and Medicaid expansion would do it. But the challenge for the state is that over time, the state's going to have to take more and more of that burden up, and we haven't really addressed that cost issue. So I think the Republican reform of the Affordable Care Act actually provided some unique opportunities that Wyoming might be able to take advantage of. You know, we already know, and I think the legislature's looking at the 1332 waiver that Alaska looked at to reinsure, to basically bring down the cost of insurance. There are also thoughts about expanding what the state's pool is. It's something I've brought up in the past to see if we can get more uniform coverage across the state. I think we've got to address health care costs in Wyoming. But ultimately, it keeps coming back to saying, how do we make sure that our costs aren't higher than the regional norms? And that'll bring competition back in.
How can we do that, though? I mean, realistically, how much could we do as a state in that area?
Well, I think the policy, let me put it this way. I think if we set policy guidelines around billing and things like that, we can begin to compare our costs against others and bring a little bit of competition into the marketplace. It's a dynamic marketplace, and there's a lot of pieces to it that are moving. And one of the challenges I think we have in Wyoming is that, you know, as large corporations come in and pick out the low-hanging fruit. You know, the Walmarts and the Walgreens and others start providing more and more services. It makes those specialized services even more expensive. So I think working with the legislature to try to find a common footprint, one that we can find common, you know, costs across the spectrum, that can help address that issue.
That population issue, though, is still a big one here because of our low population, it would appear to insurance companies and others that we have a very unhealthy population, and that just seems like that's a tough barrier.
Well, I think it is, Bob, but I also think, you know, one of the big challenges is take what's perceived as a weakness and turn it into a positive. You look at the data we have from Wyoming Health Fairs. Those data, I think, help to inform maybe some of our diagnostic practices, maybe help to analyze, you know, what the challenges are going forward. And you know, as we're going to see disruption in the medical care industry over the next several years. We're going to start moving people back out of a hospital structure and back into their homes and having more outpatient kinds of things. So maybe Wyoming really offers a great model for how we can do that, particularly if we can look at some unique, and it being pretty small, maybe that gives us more of an advantage.
Mark Gordon again, he's a Republican candidate, your Republican candidate for governor. Let's talk a little bit about education. I think I read comments that suggested that you, along with a lot of folks, think that there still could be some reductions in our education spending. How do you do that without impacting what's being taught in the classroom?
Well, Bob, what I have said is I don't think there's a silver bullet. It's not binary in how we deal with this. It's not either cut our way to solution or figure out revenues to match it. Somehow, we've got to come to a you know, some sort of a sensible, common sense solution that addresses those costs. I think it's a combination of things. One of the things we did, and I think we've talked about it, is we changed how we invested the school trust funds so that they deliver more common or more current income. That isn't going to do it all in itself. I think you look at what the efficiency study suggested, and there are some things, suggestions there that we should talk about. Regionalizing purchasing, I don't think we want to move it out of state because that doesn't help us, but regionalizing it, maybe looking at some reductions in how we do administration, that doesn't get us all the way there. And so the balance of that, I keep coming back to saying, you know, we have to allow and expect our local school boards to be able to make some more determinations about their district-by-district budget decisions. You know, we try to do things on a statewide basis a lot. I served on the school board in Johnson County, and there were challenges for our school district that I think we could have dealt with much more nimbly that if we hadn't been trying to adhere to something that the state was requiring of us.
So just the way you put that, I'm assuming you don't want any reductions or changes to local control.
No. I do want more accountability to our school boards.
Yeah, and so that's where I'm going. So how do we do that, leave it up to the locals, and without some sort of, I guess, the overhanging of the state, you know, helping or banging on or whatever the solution is?
Well, and that's, you know, I refer to it as sort of a misalignment of incentives. You know, right now we put all our weight on teachers. You know, we talk about teacher accountability, and we have a long conversation about either teachers are our most important resource or, you know, we spend more money on teachers than anyone else. And that really misses the point. I think you come back and say, we want to make sure that we have teachers that are well compensated. We want to make sure that we have efficient schools that are well administered. And now let's let the school boards, with some guidance, I mean, I'm not saying walk away from that, but let's let the school boards, with some guidance, work within those bounds.
Mark Gordon is a Republican candidate for governor. Mark, always nice having you on. Thank you.
Thank you, Bob.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed a segment or want to hear the whole show, you can go to our website, wyomingpublicmedia.org, and click on Open Spaces. You can also sign up for our podcast on that site, or find it where you get your podcasts. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Thanks to those of you who supported our Wyoming news coverage during our recent fund drive. If you are unable to make a pledge, you can help pay for that coverage with your pledge now at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.